Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. This episode of Desert Oracle Radio Replay will air on KGVM Radio on September 1st. So, if you're listening on Sunday, it's September 1st, and we are already in the month of September. Good old Wikipedia has this to say about the month. September, from the Latin septem, or seven, or mensis September, was originally the seventh of 10 months on the ancient Roman calendar that began with March. Mensis Martius, or Mars's month, and it had 29 days. After the reforms that resulted in a 12-month year, September became the ninth month but retained its name. September followed what was originally Sextilis, the sixth month, renamed Augustus in honor of the first Roman emperor, and preceded October, the eighth month that, like September, retained its numerical name contrary to its position on the calendar. A day was added to September in the mid-40s BC as part of the Julian calendar reform. Okay. Well, the more I learn about our human traditions, the more I get confused. Well, it was September 4th, 2020, when Ken Lane produced the Desert Oracle Radio episode we will hear next. The title is Secrets of the Superspectrum. Have you ever played that connections game from the New York Times, where you try to combine a series of words in categories of four? Well, you could create one of those games with the information Ken lays out in this one. You might have fun taking notes.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and the nighttime is when the hidden creatures emerge from their dens and their burrows. The badger, the desert kit fox, the kangaroo rat, the mountain lion, the scorpion, out they come into the cool, dark night. A cooler, dark night, anyway. I still sort of scratch my head and wonder. I wonder why Woden cursed me to live amongst the humans when I hear one of them say something like, well, isn't the desert just a bunch of sand? Desolate wasteland. I hardly hear anybody say that anymore. Because the one good thing that has come from Mark Zoron, the interdimensional hell virus Zuckerberg, is that because his evil company bought a little phone app called Instagram, lots of people today know that the desert is a wild and beautiful place. Some of it, anyways. The parts that don't have a 100-mile square of tract homes and Walmarts dumped atop it. When you look out on the desert, even on a hot, miserable, early September day when it's 110 degrees and even the birds seem tired of it, well, consider the ground. Ask the dust. Look on the ground and you will see footprints, or snake prints in the case of snakes, or the long lines of lizard tail tracks through the sand. Bobcat prints, the dainty little prints of innumerable desert rodents and insects, the tracks of the roadrunner, the gamble's quail, maybe even some weird tracks, like we see out here now and then from time to time. Three-toed alligator-looking tracks that go on for maybe 10 yards and just stop. Like it materialized for a quick sprint and then immediately dematerialized. Matt and DMAT, that's the jargon my ancestor Mead Lane came up with nearly a century ago during his research and travels across California, Arizona, and beyond. Mead Lane, same weird spelling, was a researcher who came up with the theory of UFOs and other 14 oddities that would inspire Dr. Jacques Vallée and the author John Keel to reach their own very similar conclusions about the monsters and fireballs and goblins and angels and gods that have haunted us since our first days, our early days as humans and proto-humans. Matt is when the thing materializes from the electromagnetic spectrum, perhaps. Maybe from another dimension, sure. But there is plenty of evidence to suggest it all happens on the electromagnetic spectrum. A spectrum is an interesting word. And in a few years, when the cable company changes its name again, because cable and phone companies change their names every few years in a desperate bid to make their customers forget who they are, we will perhaps begin using the word the way the ancient Romans did. The way scientists still do. The way the ghost hunters still do when they say specter. In Latin, spectrum and specter are variations of the same word. Some say spectrum came first, meaning simply the spectrum of visible light as seen in a rainbow or through a crystal. Specter, an apparition, was something that appeared to move into our visible light spectrum, coming in at the ultraviolet level, purple, perhaps taking brief physical form through manipulation of plasma and matter, perhaps an intelligently arranged stack of particles illuminated by light, that curious blend of particle and wave. What you know by now is to be seen, to be noticed, to maybe run through a classic routine with the human percipients, such as a landing of a craft or a brilliantly lit up fairy house with walls of glass as the Celtic people so often see in nature, or a big hairy monster with glowing red or blue eyes stomping around a forest campground late at night. Or an angel appearing at your bedside to tell you old Uncle Joe had a stroke and is going to heaven to be with Mother Mary and his siblings. Well, after the mission, the Spectre demats. It dematerializes. It is one of the strange little synchronicities of this field of study that once I became convinced by the works of Dr. Vallee and John Keel regarding the probable origins of so many of our visions and apparitions from the super spectrum. That in their own books, I would be introduced to the person who introduced them to the concept, who turned out to be my ancestor, Mead Lane. Who, like me, came west to California, and then he set up his Borderland Sciences research group within a few minutes walk of the last place that I called home in San Diego, in a little cottage. Back in the 1990s, just off Adams Avenue. It was not until recently that I found out Mead Lane was in fact my third cousin, thrice removed, as they say, from the lanes of Floyd County, Eastern Kentucky, by way of Amherst, Virginia, on the old Frontier Road. You know, when I discovered this, it gave me a weird feeling. Like when I discovered that Edgar Cayce, the great seer and psychic and clairvoyant and channeler, discovered his line of work through another one of those weird hillbilly lanes from Floyd County, Eastern Kentucky. Edgar Cayce was a strange child with a sweet disposition. He was often said to keep company with his invisible friends, the little folk, as they were called, in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which would later become known around the world as the location of a farmhouse where little goblins terrorized a family all night long back in August of 1955. It seemed like whenever Edgar Cayce would try to do the normal thing, get a normal job, he would be struck down by something and spend months in bed recovering. So it was in the year 1900. That his attempts to be a respectable insurance salesman ended back in bed, living for a year with his parents again, utterly unable to speak. A complete loss of speech. A local hypnotist and disciple of Frank Mesmer not only cured Cayce of his speech loss, he also opened up a channel between Edgar and a vast living intelligence.
That John Keel would later call the super spectrum that Philip K. Dick would call Valis.
And Edgar Cayce would go on to global fame as a Christian mystic and miraculous healer, the Sleeping Prophet, as he was known, because when the hypnotist put Cayce into this state, he would go limp, asleep but for his voice. which was now strong and true. The hypnotist was Al Lane, Albert C. Lane, again with the odd spelling. From this Eastern Kentucky clan, people who made no mark on the world except in these esoteric fields of study.
It was Dr. Al Lane who created the term readings for his sessions with Edgar Cayce.
So today we call them psychic readings, tarot card readings, oracular readings. Some people thought he might have been running the whole show. But as Edgar got his voice back and was soon busy healing the people of Hopkinsville, it was decided that the Christian God must have blessed these strange sessions. These are the deeply weird wires that connect us to a vast realm. Much like when light behaves as waves or particles depending on what we're measuring. You will find the whole history of this strange and haunted planet contains innumerable links between you and exactly what you're looking to find. I learned this as a newspaper reporter decades ago. When something bizarre happens, start looking around and you'll find a lot of connections between the players. Now, I'm not talking about UFOs or Bigfoot. I'm talking about crimes, riots, fires, things that make a mark on the world. Some kind of weird thing that triggers a series of events. Sometimes these can be explained partially by proximity, although never completely. So the cop who murdered George Floyd on a public street while people for some reason did not rain bricks and cans of soup on these evildoers, that cop not only knew George Floyd personally, but he knew him as a coworker. They worked together. Because George Floyd's murderer was white, he went from Walmart and fast food to the police department to be a murderer for hire. And you know what happened to George Floyd. But you also know that what happened on that street is reverberating right now, this minute, around the world. As George Floyd's little 6-year-old daughter said right there for the news cameras to broadcast by satellite to every corner of this planet, my daddy changed the world. When I was a kid, you could buy a novelty penny with a little engraving of JFK next to Lincoln's head. The penny was real and altered, which is a crime, but whatever. Crime is our business here in America, top down. And the penny was glued to a cardboard bookmark with a list of coincidences regarding Kennedy and Lincoln's lives and violent deaths. Both were sacrificed by the evil that lives at the heart of this country, human sacrifices. Great bloody rituals performed for public consumption. Lincoln murdered by a lone nut in a theater filled with an audience of Washington insiders. Kennedy murdered for the press and the cameras to be seen by a horrified world. Kennedy's lone nut was Lee Harvey Oswald. Someone who renounced his citizenship, moved to the Soviet Union, and somehow came right back to the USA with no questions asked, where he immediately shows up in the news doing strange things, like advocating a fair deal with Cuba. He did this outside the International Trademark Office building in New Orleans, where he handed my mother a hands-off Cuba flyer when she was returning from lunch to work in Clay Shaw's building, the International Trademark, the corner of Camp and Common Streets. It was on the TV news at night, the strange performance. Who really killed John Kennedy? We will always wonder, because the heart of America is troubled and diseased, and the papers continue to be locked away. Oh, just for another 20 years, and maybe another 20 years after that, forever. Some say the godfather of New Orleans, Carlos Marcello, ordered the hit on both Kennedys after they teamed up to break up his syndicate. You know, in the Godfather movies, when the mafioso takes the fifth in the hearing 100 times and everybody's going crazy because he's getting away with it? That was Carlos Marcello in real life. I wish I'd known more about this stuff when his grandson sat next to me in third grade at a rundown Lutheran school in New Orleans East, of all places. Because it turns out the family was hiding the kids from the hitmen from the other families, who were not even allowed to visit New Orleans without the godfather's permission. Our Savior Lutheran. Well, I guess it worked for Marcello's grandson, who is still alive, rumors say. You can't even find out the kids' names on the internet, so I will not mention his on the radio. My third grade history project was a photo album full of clippings from JFK's assassination and the aftermath. My mother kept them all. I wonder what Marcello's grandson thought about all that. Clay Shaw, who was later prosecuted unsuccessfully by New Orleans DA Jim Garrison for Shaw's alleged and likely role in the assassination conspiracy, was the kind of character you'd expect to be involved in a lot of weird stuff, but it's always weirder than you think. Clay Shaw reportedly wound up in possession of metal wreckage from a supposed flying saucer that nearly crashed into the waters off Maury Island between Tacoma and Seattle. There was a group of a half dozen saucers, one wobbling in the center with strange materials falling off. Some of this slag supposedly struck the small workboat piloted by a couple of harbor patrolmen, injuring one, or the son of one in one telling, who was riding along, and killing their dog. White lava, white metal, something like that. June 21st, 1947. This was 4 days before what we call the beginning of the flying saucer era, June 24th of that same strange year, when pilot Kenneth Arnold witnessed 9 strange craft, one shaped like a silver bat-winged boomerang, over the mountains outside Seattle. So Ray Palmer, the Pulp magazine editor, had already hired Kenneth Arnold to write a first-person version of his historic UFO encounter that was on the front pages nationwide in the days after it happened. When Palmer heard from one of the men who supposedly witnessed the Maury Island incident, he asked Kenneth Arnold to investigate. Arnold, in the weeks after his original sighting, had already racked up another 3 sightings. Because as you learn, you don't just have one close encounter. Maybe you only remember one close encounter. When Kenneth Arnold arrived, he interviewed the two men, Fred Chrisman and Harold Dahl. He collected the samples of the stuff and quickly called Army Air Force Intelligence Officer Lieutenant Frank M. Brown, someone he just happened to know. Lieutenant Brown rushed a couple of intelligence officers from California to the scene by way of a B-25 from the old Hamilton Army Airfield in Marin County. Well, the story says they were unimpressed with the samples, although it's hard to know where that story came from, as both officers died on the flight back when the B-25 burst into flames and crashed. If the name Fred Chrisman sounds familiar, it's because this same shady character, who wasn't really a harbor policeman on Maury Island at all, would later be identified as one of the three tramps on the grassy knoll on November 22, 1963, standing just behind the crowd waiting to see President John F. Kennedy's motorcade come by that day in Dallas. Chrisman, according to the major threads of JFK conspiracy theory, shot JFK or helped for Carlos Marcello and or the CIA. I wonder if George Bush Sr. ever talked about that, maybe on his deathbed 2 years ago, because he was there too on CIA business. Even though he was supposedly a small town oilman in West Texas in those days. Details of Bush Sr.'s CIA work in the 1960s were published by The Nation magazine in 1988, the year the Skull and Bones man and by then former CIA director was elected President of the United States. What did Clay Shaw do with the UFO swag from the Maury Island hoax? From Amboy to Zizix and across the Great Mojave Wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. The soundscapes you heard right up until this point were all by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I gotta say that because I say the credits during the closing theme music, which is the only music on this show you will generally hear that is not by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I did a little remote viewing experiment with some of you last week. Thanks for sending your descriptions and sketches. One I got said, on your table, it's a binding of desert oracles. My wife says it's an armadillo. Got a lot like that. Very funny. Very funny, people. Two different people, apparently of no relation, wrote in to say that they saw a cartoon character figure, with one saying it was Snoopy, the cartoon dog. One listener sent in a sketch of something like a vine or a curious ladder. I'll post the picture tonight. Sorry I haven't got around to it this week. But it's a little tripod made of metal, the kind you put on a table for a camera or an audio recorder, with the little nubbin you screw into the device. Very simple, clean line, so I thought that might make an impression. We'll try again. Trying is how you learn. That's what they say in the Zoom meetings we have instead of school now. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, whether on the radio at KZDZ in the Joshua Tree High Desert, Friday nights, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., Or maybe you're listening on the new Lookout FM in Los Angeles and Burbank. That's some good news. Whatever the case, we appreciate it, and we will be back with you next week. Watch out for this heat wave and everything else, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGBM 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio. The National Weather Service says meteorological autumn, which is different from standard astronomical autumn, begins September 1st and ends November 30th. The time of the autumnal equinox, at which the sun approaches the southern hemisphere, marking the start of astronomical autumn in the northern hemisphere, is September 22nd, approximately. Okay, so I know what the equinox is, but meteorological autumn? Well, I tried to find out some more information about that. Meteorologists and Australia and most of the temperate countries in the southern hemisphere use a definition based on Gregorian calendar months, with autumn being September, October, and November in the northern hemisphere, and March, April, and May in the southern hemisphere. I guess it's just a matter of preference, but why? This is not helping my confusion. Okay, well, here's a little piece from AccuWeather that sort of explains the reason. And don't be thrown off by their example of meteorological spring.
The exact start of spring depends on who you ask, a meteorologist or an astronomer.
Most people follow the astronomical calendar, with spring starting on the March equinox.
This is the time when the sun's most direct rays are right over the equator, and as a result, we have about 12 hours of daylight followed by about 12 hours of darkness everywhere around the world.
The spring equinox takes place in March and ends in the summer solstice, which happens in June. The exact time and date of the equinox changes from year to year. This makes it challenging for researchers to calculate seasonal statistics like temperature or rainfall from year to year, which is where meteorological seasons come in.
Meteorologists look at the calendar when determining the seasons, with spring starting on March 1st every year. Since meteorological seasons never change, it's easier to compare one year to another. No matter what happens, meteorological spring will start on March 1st and will end on the last day of May.
The only exception is winter.
Meteorological winter starts on December 1st every year and continues through the end of February. So once every 4 years, we have a leap year. So on those years, meteorological winter is a little bit longer than every other year.
For AccuWeather, I'm Christina Shalhu.
So I think that helps. It's kind of all about data collection. Well, September is also National Honey Month, National Literacy Month, and Better Breakfast Month. September 5th is National Be Late for Something Day. How fun is that? This day is sponsored by the Procrastinators Club of America. September is Animal Pain Awareness Month. It's also Baby Safety Month. And of course, this is Labor Day weekend. When I was a kid, I grew up in a little farming town in the central part of the United States. And here's what I remember about Labor Day there. It was a time when the carnival would come to town, and the whole city streets were just lined with carnival rides and games. There were the great big canvas 4-H tents. Lots and lots of people. Everybody, all the farmers, everybody would come into town and mingle. And, you know, for several days over Labor Day weekend. And on Labor Day itself, there was a big parade. And, oh man, I'm guessing hundreds of Shriners would come into town. They were from all over the state, and I was told by people that were supposed to know that the Shriners would come for Labor Day because the city of Schuyler, or maybe it was the Shriners there, promised them a big party with lots of booze at the Oak Ballroom. And, yeah, so that was the deal. The closest thing to that I've seen here, which is kind of minus the Shriners, is the Manhattan Potato Days Parade. It's kind of got a charming little town feel to it, and it's pretty cool. But I don't remember anything about laboring workers in the parade or the carnival or the festival. I guess maybe because it was a farming town. But I've learned a little bit more, and I'm going to play a couple things from history.com that talk about Labor Day and its origins. Maybe you already know this stuff, but I didn't. So enjoy.
It has its roots in, well, labor. History explains Labor Day. Pullman, Illinois, a company town, was home to employees of the Pullman Railroad Sleeping Car Company. But in the summer of 1894, their union organized a strike, demanding higher pay and lower rents. Soon, railroad workers across the country were boycotting Pullman cars. Riots broke out. Hundreds of railway cars burned, so President Grover Cleveland deployed 12,000 troops to break the strike. The protests were crushed, but not without casualties. Yet only 6 days after the strike was over, a bill arrived on Cleveland's desk calling for a national holiday to celebrate America's workforce. Cleveland signed the bill. The government's relationship with American workers was on the mend. Since then, workers across the country have celebrated with parades and picnics.
Most of us, Labor Day means time off from work, maybe a barbecue to mark the official end of summer. But how much do you know about what inspired its creation? The labor movement. The labor movement started around the Industrial Revolution, a time in the late 19th century when America exploded in size and wealth. Advances in technology created manufacturing jobs, and people moved to cities to work in factories. But it wasn't the workers getting rich. It was their bosses who raked in big profits by paying low wages for long hours. Fed up with big business, industrial workers created unions to fight for better conditions. Unions are the backbone of the labor movement. But what exactly did they accomplish? Well, for one, you can thank the labor movement for your work-free weekend. In the late 1800s, the average American worked as much as 100 hours a week. Unions held strikes to demand shorter work weeks and an 8-hour workday to make time for family and relaxation. The most famous strike, the Haymarket Riots, happened in Chicago on May 1st, 1886, with thousands of people taking to the streets, and their voices only grew louder from there. The labor movement also protested child labor. Remember those black and white photos of children with dirty, sad faces wearing overalls and beanie caps? Those kids weren't playing outside, but they were working in factories. In 1881, unions demanded that businesses stop hiring kids under 14. And slowly but surely, measures against child labor caught on around the country. Eventually, all those protests got results. In 1938, Congress passed a law called the Fair Labor Standards Act, which set the 40-hour work week, regulated child labor, and set standards for minimum wage and overtime pay. In the 1930s and 1940s, workers were also able to negotiate health benefit plans from their employers. Though union membership is on a decline today, it's undeniable that the labor movement forever changed the way Americans live, work, and even relax.
And this is the part of the show where I talk about events coming up. Well, this is an event you might want to attend. The 5th annual Ferry Village opened on August 30th and will be open through September 22nd. It's located amid the winding, wooded paths of Glen Lake Rotary Park in Bozeman. Bumblewood Thicket will contain all new ferry homes and businesses created by talented local artists also known as fairy architects. Bumblewood Thicket Fairy Village is self-guided, free, and open to all from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. Glen Lake Rotary Park is accessed from Manly Road. Park near the large pavilion and look for the trail and the This Way to Bumblewood Thicket sign opposite the lake. Follow the signage on the trail. And Tuesday, September 3rd, is the 60th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. Now, the Wilderness Act of 1964 established the National Wilderness Preservation System, a national network of more than 800 federally designated wilderness areas. These wilderness areas are managed by the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the U.S. Forest Service. You can find the text of the act online. It's pretty extensive, but for a first-person account of life working in the wilderness, the Bob Marshall Wilderness in particular, there is a new book out. It's called Hush of the Land, A Lifetime in the Bob Marshall Wilderness. It was written by Arnold Smoke Elder and Eva Marie Maggie. They will be reading and commemorating the 60th anniversary of the Wilderness Act on Tuesday this week at Flathead Valley Community College up in Kalispell, if you're going up that way, at 6 p.m. in the evening. I think the authors will be in Bozeman on September 14th at Country Bookshelf 2, but you really should check with the store to find out for sure. My thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio and to the good folks at KGVM who make space for this show. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Sounds today came from various areas in the Gallatin Valley, and I would love to hear from you, so please call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. As far as I know, the number still works. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Until then, stay well and sweet dreams. And in honor of labor everywhere, I'm going to close it out today with a couple of songs about the labor movement. The first one is from Pete Seeger, Which Side Are You On? And we're going to follow it up with Elaine Perkey singing One Day More. And I got to say, that song is about persistence. And persistence pays off in so many areas. Persistence is what got us the Wilderness Act. So hang in there with the cause that you believe in the most. Be persistent. And here's to all the hard workers.
With the Union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
you are. They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Don't scab for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
One day more, people, let me tell you what we're fighting for. We're fighting for our future, don't you understand? And we don't need your pity, we just need your helping hand. To fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, one day more. If the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. If Emmett Boyle thinks he can win, he'll get a big surprise. 'Cause we're honest folks and we will shut him down to size. We'll throw out the guards, clean out the yards, cut that big boy down, but we'll still be around. To fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. We've got to change the way things are, make people understand our working class is being denied the rights in a free land. Our government lets criminals run free to steal again, and then takes the jobs of honest working women and men. We'll fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. Let's change the laws, remove the flaws, and start all over new. Demand our rights, take back our land, spread freedom through and through. Keep the scabs out of the White House, vote union brothers in. And then the feds can't ever take us off in a ball and chains again. We'll fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more, one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, people, let me tell you what we're fighting for. We're fighting for your future, don't you understand? Hey, you won't need our pity, you just need our helping hand. To fight one day more, if the companies can hold out 20 years, we can hold out one day more. One day more, if the companies can hold out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. Thank you.